Welcome to the Theorist Composer Collaboration, a podcast interview series highlighting modern composers and music theorists. My name is Aaron DiZarilla. I'm the host of this podcast and also a music theorist myself. Today I'll be talking with the composer Dr. Robert Gross alongside his piece Penumbra. Dr. Gross and I discuss his background, various music occupations, several technical approaches to composition, and much more. Without further ado, this is an excerpt from Penumbra, and welcome to the TCC. Again, the music that you were just listening to is from the piece Penumbra, from the composer Robert Gross. Speaking of which, Dr. Robert Gross, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing there, Aaron?
I'm doing wonderful. I'm happy to have you on today. And could you please introduce yourself personally, professionally, academically, whatever you choose?
Sure. Well, personally, I'm a husband and father living in Delaware. Professionally, I am a freelance composer and music theorist with a DMA in composition from the University of Southern California. And academically, I'm currently entering the PhD program in music theory this fall at the University of Maryland, where I will also be teaching ear training and oral skills. Woohoo!
Very fun, very fun. A lot of exciting things there. I'm going to ask you later in this podcast about your venture back into academia on the side of music theory as opposed to composition. Not sure. Every day that I hear someone call themselves, I've heard freelance composer a number of times, of course, but not necessarily freelanced music theorist. And if you could, I would actually like to jump into that right there. You're particularly unique, Dr. Gross, in the ensemble of people that I've had onto this podcast, where you are seemingly in equal parts a composer and a theorist, or at least you have plenty of theory bona fides yourself presenting at the National Society for Music Theory and so on. How does your experience and interest in music theory interact, let's say even just intellectually, with your composer bona fides?
Well, that's a great question. I've always been interested very specifically in what I call composer theorist hyphenates. People from yesteryear that included figures like Milton Babbitt, George Perle, Benjamin Boritz, people like that. And that extends today. I'm very much interested in today's composer theorist hyphenates, People I would want to mention would be my good friend Evan Ware. Other theorist composers would include people like Dmitri Tomacho, Miguel Roig Francolli, and Catherine Purkinskis. My interest in music theory and composition kind of go hand in hand because I find that you can't really take a lesson compositionally from composers that you admire all the time. You can't take a lesson from Stravinsky, he's dead. So the next best thing to me is to analyze the music, dig into the score, find out what's ticking, and go from there and glean composition lessons that are useful for me as a composer.
Certainly. And you know what I find interesting is that I've heard a similar sort of thrust for analysis from other composers and other people who have been experienced in composition, but rarely do they connect it literally to music theory or the field of music theory. Why do you think that is?
For some reason, I think the reason is historical. I mean, I think in the academic parlance, the two universes became very strictly and professionally bifurcated. Music theory, you can get a degree in it. You can get a PhD or as the terminal degree in music theory. You can get a PhD or DMA as the terminal degree in music composition. I think that composers have drifted. And that may be too strong a word, drift. I mean, I don't mean any negative connotation by that, but I mean, I think composers have become more confidently intuitive in their composing, and teach intuitively and to teach trusting instincts. And I mean, I as a composition student myself, I was taught a lot about honing instincts as a composer, whereas the music theory side is really, very rational, intellectualized, and there's nothing wrong with it. I think that that's how it should be. So I think composition has changed a little bit in moving away from, the charts and graphs of pre-compositional device and gone more into an intuitive realm would be my guess. I don't have any empirical data to back that up. I think it would be a subject of a very interesting musicological study, however.
Certainly, probably something at a dissertation level because that's such a big concept. And so we're talking about the different parts of you intellectually. One thing that I wanted to touch on because it doesn't fit super smoothly into the other parts of the podcast, but I found it so interesting that I want to ask you about your background. I saw in the biography you sent me, you're also a music therapist or in music therapy. Can you talk a bit about that, how that lands in your life and what that's like?
Well, I'm leaving music therapy. That's
Okay.
one way that it fits into my life is by leaving it. It's and there's nothing wrong with music therapy. I did it for I either studied it or practiced it for a total combination of about 10 years in my life, and I missed theory so much that I missed teaching theory, and I missed the intellectual exchange of theory with professors, mentors, and with students, that I just decided that I needed to make the move back into the theory realm. But yeah, I music therapy has been very good for me. It's taught me unconditional positive regard for clients, which I think will make me a better teacher, especially when I teach oral skills. That I'm not out to make anybody cry, I'm not out to be a hard, you know what anymore, really. I used to be when I was a younger man as a professor, well, instructor rather. I shouldn't use the P word. I was not technically a P word, but as an instructor of theory and oral skills, I was a bit more strict and hard line than I am now. Music therapy is it's basically using music to help people with problems. Sometimes it's with physical problems like trying to rehabilitate walking or movement, and you know, you play music to a certain rhythm that inspires movement and things like that. Sometimes it's psychological, you know, music therapy, and that's more where I fell in, was music therapy for, you know, purposes of alleviating depression, anxiety, things like that. I studied it at Texas Woman's University, which despite its name is a co-ed institution. And I got into it because, I'll try to make the story very, very brief, but my best friend was, he was blind congenitally, and he had something called Meniere's disease. And he and I, he were, you know, collaborators together in music. He's an he was an electronic composer. He's no longer with us, I'm afraid. He died in 2016, But around 2014, he came to me and said that he had Meniere's disease, and because of that, which is an audio disorder, he was hearing music out of tune, which was really problematic for his music making. So I suggested to him, well, Ken, why don't you take your electronic musical expertise and focus on anything but pitch? Write a piece, make it as long as you want, but make it this extravaganza where you are exploring rhythm, texture, timbre, form, structure, rhythm. Did I say rhythm already? But all these non-pitch parameters, you know, focus on those and see what you get, because pitch is obviously out the window for you. And he came back 20 with a 20-minute extravaganza that we later called Discord, and eventually formed an experimental electronic music duo called Blind Labyrinth. And as Blind Labyrinth, for about a year, we developed about maybe 15 to 20 pieces of experimental electronic music together. And the amazing thing was that he got his hearing back. His pitched location centers returned to him. He was able to sing in tune. He was able to hear music in tune. And it was a really amazing thing. And I started to do some research on what it was we were doing together. And everything just came coming back to me as music therapy. And it sounded like something that I would be interested in. You know, I've always been interested in the bridge between music and medicine. I got in touch with, I was living in Texas at the time. I had been teaching at Rice University, and it was a 3-year contract. My contract came up, and I was sort of at loose ends. So I got in touch with Mike Zanders at Texas Woman's University, who had an excellent music therapy program, and introduced myself, did an interview a few days later. And then for the next 10 years, is doing music therapy. I worked a lot with kids with, you know, either, you know, motor function issues, or with, you know, depression and anxiety issues. I worked a lot with autism, with autistic kids as well.
Well, it's certainly beautiful work. And on that anecdote you gave, that was a wonderful story. Talk about restrictions breeding creativity in composition, certainly with that. And thank you for sharing that. Wonderful to hear. I think you're the only person I've had on to the podcast who has direct experience with music therapy, and it's an important and growing part of our broad field of music research and intellectualism. So thank you for sharing that. And so let's get into, we've been ping-ponging around the different parts of your musical identity, and let's get to the one that we're featuring here today in particular, which is as a composer. Now, Dr. Gross, how would you generally identify your music, your sound, and the music that you make?
Oh, well, my music, I think I like to say it comes in three different flavors. It's like the Neapolitan ice cream box. There's neoclassical Rob, there's the adventurous post-tonal Rob, and then there's experimental Rob. And sometimes I combine these in the same piece. Sometimes I keep them separate. Neoclassical is, I'm usually using, you know, a fairly tonal and conservative language. And I enjoy that because I think it communicates very directly with people. People know if it's good right away. You don't have to, you know, puzzle over it. You don't get the, oh, that was interesting comment. But I also, you know, have more adventurous tastes and am interested in post-tonal music as well. And I'm very much interested in how post-tonal music structures itself. How do you create structures and forms when there's a vacuum and there's no sort of a priori factors that necessitate what you must do? And that's always been a fascinating question. And then that kind of leads into my experimental side. I mean, I really admire a lot of the works of John Cage. And I had a teacher once who once said, you know, the next time somebody tells you that John Cage is the musical Antichrist, you tell them to go back and listen to the music. And I stand by that because I think some of John Cage's pieces, especially the number pieces, are really, really gorgeous. I mean, you get some really good results when you get a committed performance, when you get a performance that takes it seriously, that's not trying to, you know, take the mick out of it, as our British friends would say. You can get some really lovely, interesting in a good way, results from those pieces.
I would certainly agree. There's a lot to pick from that's not just the 433s.
Oh yeah, that needs to be retired, in my opinion.
I agree. It's such an old joke and
Yeah.
whatever. You know, speaking about your post-tonal interests, one thing that cued my interest quite a lot with your posts on Facebook was it was a little bit ago at this point, but you were making some prolongational sketches of post-tonal works. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that's like a wonderfully like anti what the original like kind of prolongational thing is, repurposing it for structural means like you were talking about with your own music.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks for noticing. Sure. I've been long interested in the issue of post-tonal prolongation. It's probably my primary theoretical ambition is to investigate the thorny issue of post-tonal prolongation, or what I call post-tonal design coherence. I for a long time, for about 15 years, I insisted that prolongation was possible in the post-tonal idiom, despite what Joe Strauss has to say about it. Joe Strauss, for those of you who may not know, wrote in 1987 a very seminal article called "The Problem of Prolongation in Post-Tonal Music," and he basically denied that prolongation could be possible in a post-tonal idiom. And I fought against it. I railed against it. I rallied against it. I wrote papers against it. I presented against it. And then ultimately came to the conclusion that he was right all along. Because, as a matter of intellectual honesty, I wrote an article called Contrapuntal Principles of Post-Tonal Prolongation, where I outlined five different ways that I think post-tonal counterpoint could lead to a prolongational situation in post-tonal music. But then when I had to, and, but that was theorizing. When I had to actually take it and analyze, I analyzed the song set of Webern Lieder. And I tried to apply these principles, and it just did not work. So I had to concede, as a matter of intellectual honesty, that Professor Strauss was actually right. That prolongation is a pitch-only domain, in which the presence of a sonority exerts its influence, even when it is not literally present. In the post-tonal domain, I believe that non-pitch parameters promote the importance of pitches in the absence of functional tonality. So again, you're looking at rhythm, you're looking at structure, you're looking at form, you're often looking at motive, contour shapes, all these things that can point to which notes are the more prominent notes and which notes are the more backgrounded notes in a post-tonal landscape. But that's not prolongation, because prolongation is a pitch-only domain. So I call it design coherence. That's a term that was suggested to me by my good friend Kevin Clifton, who is an excellent music theorist at Sam Houston State in Texas. That's what I've been doing with my time lately. I've been making charts and graphs that show the design coherence, particularly in one piece called "Movements for Piano and Orchestra" by Stravinsky. And my charts borrow a lot of graphic conceits from Schenker. It's not Schenkerian analysis, because Schenker, you know, was purely interested in tonal music. So I'm very quick to point out that this is not Schenkerian analysis per se. But it does borrow a lot of the same sort of graphic conceits. I mean, whole notes that stand for deeper structures, you know, filled in note heads that stand for more shallow structures, beaming groups together that show linear progressions, and so on and so forth. That's what I put up on Facebook that you noticed. So I'm still in the midst of working on that piece, Movements for Piano and Orchestra. It's an extensive piece. It's about 10 minutes long. and it's pretty thorny and it's dense and it's 12 tone. But Stravinsky has, you know, a way of using rotational arrays to obscure the original initiating 12 tone row. So the 12 tone row doesn't always manifest itself in ways that you would expect. And so I find it very fruitful to investigate the subsets of the tone row. You know, in the case of Stravinsky, there are a lot of 012 trichords and a lot of 016 trichords, for instance, that I am able to graph and show graphically and beam together as a group and things like that when they occur. So that's what I've been doing in a nutshell. I hope to get a paper out of this. I hope to approach a journal with it. And that's what I'm working on as we speak.
I mean, I feel like there's a reason why issues of prolongation, and as you were talking about, it's almost generally always been primarily pitch prolongation. There's a reason why it has stuck around so long. Some of it can be a thorny reason, but also purely just because it's interesting. And it's really fascinating. And I applaud you on your work for expanding the idea of prolongation into post-tonal theory as something that I actually quickly wrote down that Strauss article that you mentioned, because I'm not familiar with it. So I'll have to dig into that, because I've been thinking about issues of prolongation primarily along the rhythmic, within rhythmic motives within my own research in rap and hip hop. So that's something I need to dig deeper in myself. But thank you for sharing that. I actually realized that the next question I was going to ask was about your music research. So this is perfect. Yes.
That's it pretty much. I'm also very much interested in disabled composers, because I am a disabled composer. I have depression and diabetes. I'm very upfront about it. I have been hospitalized for my depression, so it's a fairly serious thing. I'm upfront about that too, because I think we have to absolutely resist the stigma associated with so-called mental illness. So I have become very deeply interested in disability studies in music. And again, all roads seem to lead to Joe Strauss for me, because his work in the disability studies and music sort of Venn diagram are foundational. He wrote a book specifically about post-tonal music called Broken Beauty has to do with the ways in which post-tonal music can manifest disability as a metaphor in a number of interesting ways, and challenges us to accept post-tonal music as its own thing, as a valid way of moving music forward, much as he challenges us to find validity in disability as merely one variation on human existence of many. And I think that's a really interesting and profound idea that drives me forward. I have an article that is on revise and resubmit status at Music Theory Online. I am presently revising and resubmitting on the subject of two disabled composers, one named Molly Joyce, who is an excellent composer who only has the use of one hand, and she plays on an organ and then manipulates the organ sounds electronically. So she's primarily an electroacoustic composer. And I analyze a work of hers called Cure, which discusses issues in the disability community mapped to her music. And then the other composer is Galen Lee, who is a composer who has so-called brittle bone disease. I don't remember what the technical name for that is. She is a folk rock artist, and she won the Tiny Desk concert competition at NPR a few years ago. And she's a fantastic composer, songwriter, singer, and violinist. She plays the violin. She's very small statured, so she plays the violin like a cello.
Oh, I think I've seen that Tiny Desk performance. That
you
really
probably
rings a bell.
Have, because she won big, and now she's got a huge career, and deservedly so. So I've analyzed both Molly Joyce's and Galen Lee's music from the perspective of disability and what their music tells us about disability. So that's another sort of venture in my music research.
That's
for home.
wonderful. That's wonderful. And this maybe paints on my own ignorance of not being aware of the scholarship, but at the most recent Society for Music Theory conference, seeing that there was a disability research interest group, and there were a fair number of papers on it, I was not aware that it's been around for a while, the research area, but also is growing, which.
Yeah, it's been around for about 20 years, I would say. Strauss did a lot to spearhead it. There are others whose names, alas, elude me off the top of my head. But as far as I know, though, a lot of the research has to do with tropes in music that may stand for disability, topics, tropes and topics, topoi, that may communicate the concept of disability. Certainly, there's a lot of study of opera, disabled characters in opera, Billy Budd, etc., comes to mind. As far as I know, I may be wrong about this, so don't quote me, but I think I'm the only one so far that's taken it upon himself to analyze specifically the works of other disabled composers and to see how the disability of being disabled manifests itself in music. I work with a lot of disabled musicians and with disabled dancers. In August, I have a concert with Abilities Dance Boston. I've worked with them on several occasions. This is a disabled dancer troupe of disabled and non-disabled dancers collaborating together. It's a really wonderful program, and I've written music for them on several occasions. The show is August 9th at 2 p.m. in Boston, on a beach, and I don't know the name of the beach, but if you Google Abilities Dance Boston, you'll find all the information.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there is someone else. It's a big world, but I mean, as far as I know,
There
you're
must
also,
be. There must be.
but as far as I could tell, yeah, you are. But I think it's wonderful research, and I applaud you for continuing to work towards that. And so let's turn our attention to the piece that we're featuring today, Penumbra.
Yes.
So what can you tell us, and it's for string quartet, what can you tell us about this piece also relating to the title Penumbra?
Well, penumbra means shadow, and specifically sometimes in astronomy, it means the shadow that outlines an eclipse. I first encountered the word penumbra in constitutional law, which I took a year of as an undergrad. There's a case, Griswold v. Connecticut, in which one of the justices writes that there is a right to privacy in the Constitution that comes from the emanations and penumbra of the Bill of Rights. And I just always emanations and penumbras, plural. And that word always stuck with me. I thought it was a neat word. And I thought that the idea of the outline of an eclipse fighting through to try to get light from outside the moon shadow was a striking image. It's the image of my album Penumbra, which is available on New Focus Recordings, plug plug. I just thought that was a powerful image, and sometimes visual imagery inspires compositions. It's a piece that I felt that I wanted to write. It was not a commissioned piece. I grew up listening to string quartets because my uncle was in one. My uncle was the John Kochanowski was the violist of the Concord String Quartet, which in the 1970s and 1980s was probably the most widely commissioning body for new American string quartets in the country. They worked a lot with Jacob Truckman and Gunther Schuller and Milton Babbitt, all these figures from the 1970s that they commissioned. Probably George Rochberg was the most frequent customer. He commissioned four or five quartets from them, which was one of which the third quartet became very controversial because it was, it had an unabashedly tonal middle movement that really offended a lot of people in 1973, the year I was born, by the way. So, yeah, Rochberg, I wrote a paper on the third quartet that appeared in Perspectives of New Music about 15 years ago. But anyway, I grew up listening to string quartets, and I felt that I had a I felt I had a good full length string quartet in me, and I felt I had to write it. I got in touch with the Cordova Quartet because they were in residence at Rice University where I was teaching at the time, and they agreed to record it for me very generously. And then they broke up. My piece was the last piece that they did before breaking up, and I don't know why they broke up. But they assured me that I had nothing to do with it. So my conscience is clear. You know, bands break up. I mean, for probably the usual reasons, you know, but whatever. What can you do? It's a shame because they were awfully good. And I think that the recording they did for me was really spectacular.
Well, it was my next question of, was it your fault? I'm just kidding. No,
Yeah.
it wasn't.
No, it was not.
No. But okay, wonderful, wonderful. And so one of the most striking, there's lots of different striking elements of this piece. They performed it very well, and of course you wrote it very well, but one of the things that I loved about it was your use of timbre. I also am an admirer of string quartets, almost purely because I'm a violinist, and
Excellent.
I've grown up playing in string quartets, listening to them, and just being aware of the different possibilities. And I know from speaking with younger composers, my age or younger, is that one of the daunting things about writing for a string quartet is the daunting how to make it different or how to do something, you know, maybe not necessarily experimental, but something that separates them musically, which you can debate whether or not they need to, quote unquote, so on,
Right.
whatever.
Yeah, that's an open question.
Yes.
And I don't think there's a right answer to that question. I think it's personal to every composer, and that's fine.
I would agree. I would agree. But with this piece, one of the things that stands out for me is your use of timbre, particularly. I love how you emulate percussion. You make the string quartet feel like a sinfonia. It feels like there's more than four instruments happening. And so this is a very open-ended question. In Penumbra, how did you tackle the structure of a string quartet, being an admirer of the ensemble, to get such varied sounds out of the group?
Well, thanks. I appreciate your thoughts on that. You know, I mean, the percussiveness of the string quartet, I mean, that comes from inspirations from other string quartets directly. I mean, Shostakovich's Eighth Quartet, where Stalin is knocking on the door to get Shostakovich in the middle of the night. I mean, that's an image that stayed with me pretty powerfully. I tried to explore all the timbral possibilities I could. I have to confess that I am not one for a lot of extended techniques. No particular reason for that other than just because, and I hate to admit this, and I'm kind of embarrassed to admit this, but they often make my ears hurt. And that's the only reason. It's not anything philosophical against it. It's not a knock against composers who do it and do it well. It just sometimes it's not for me. But I do think that, as I mentioned before in our discussion about the prolongation issue, non-pitch parameters are crucial in a post-functional environment when you don't have functional tonality to avail upon to tell the listener what are the important ideas versus what are the more supportive background ideas. So to me, composing in penumbra was all about trying to draw listener attention through timbre to those motives and ideas that were the most important. The percussive idea was definitely one of them. There's a motive also that is a falling whole tone followed by an ascending semitone followed by a falling whole tone again, and that creates a tetrachord of 0 1 2 3. And so I whenever a 0 1 2 3 tetrachord came into the piece, I wanted to give it a little extra oomph and a little extra prominence through the non-pitch parameters that are working in the piece. I've read a lot of the idea of non-pitch parameters promoting the important notes in a post-tonal environment is not a new idea, and it's not my idea either. A theorist that I want to give a shout out to is Patricia Howland. Howland, who proposes something she calls the integrated parametric structure, or IPS. And she says that in post-tonal music, you can find five different dimensions, which she calls tension release, departure return, symmetry, directionality, and steady state. I think about that in reverse. I reverse engineer those steady states. I mean, she uses these domains analytically to find them in existing post-tonal music. I reverse engineer it and try to create these in pieces that I write, and particularly in Penumbra, where I'm really exploring texture a lot. It's probably my most textural piece because I'm typically more thematically driven. And even in a post-tonal context, I like to try to write something that's, possibly singable potentially. But in this case, I'm really exploring. I'm exploring the tensions and releases of texture.
That certainly was palpable throughout the piece. I mean, it's the first question that I asked you, so I mean, I think you were successful in that. So let's talk about thematically or melodically, however you want to phrase that, because you were just speaking that you are generally driven by a melodic or a thematic element within your music, and I'm wondering how you constructed it within this piece, because I would, I mean, he probably didn't originate this term, but something that one of my teachers in undergrad said about his music, Professor or Dr. Richards at University of Florida, he would say tonal adjacent. He would call his music that. And that's what I would describe this as, because there is underlying a function behind a lot of it. There's tension, there's release. A lot of that is illustrated through the texture, like you were just talking about, but it also exists in a pitch content as well. And so this is a roundabout way of asking, how did you think about constructing your thematic material, especially in conversation with your textural purposes?
Well, I had a teacher too, a mentor. He wasn't ever my formal teacher, but he was a mentor when I studied briefly at Manhattan School of Music, named Nils Vigeland, who sprung this on me in my audition for MSM, sprung this idea on me that I never forgot. He said that he doesn't think that the conflict between composers in the 20th century is tonal versus atonal. He thinks it's pulsic versus melodic. And to illustrate this, he says, you look throughout history, Stravinsky is a pulsic composer, Schoenberg is a melodic composer, Verdi is a pulsic composer, Wagner is a melodic composer, Schubert is a melodic composer. Beethoven is a pulsate composer, and so on and so forth. It's not foolproof. They all did things pretty well, the composers that we admired. But primarily, there's something to that stuck with me, and I said, yeah, I think what I want to do is I want to try to maximize both the pulsic and the melodic dimensions in whatever I'm doing, because I think Mozart did that. I think Mozart is probably the quintessential composer who maximized both the pulsic and melodic values in his compositions, and I think that's something that really I try to do in most of my pieces. I'm very much also influenced by the Second Viennese school, but for different reasons with each composer. When I am trying to think more lyrically, I look more closely at Baird. When I'm trying to think about form and structuralism, I'm looking more closely at Schoenberg. And when I'm looking at economy of means and density and making the most, getting the most punch out of a gesture, then I'm looking at Webern. It's interesting to me that three composers who are so different from one another get lumped together under one blanket umbrella term, Second Viennese School, because to me, you can't really confuse these composers for one another. But I don't know if that answers your question or not,
Oh,
but
it does. What an interesting interview or audition that must have been. Put
yeah,
that
and then
upon
he asked me, well, do you think that your music is more melodic, or do you think your music is more pulsic? And at the time, I had to say it was more melodic, but I never forgot that.
I mean, I wouldn't forget that either. It does answer my question. I think that those composers are looped together. Because for historical timekeeping and also their proximate physical and I guess intellectual proximity to each other, even if their music doesn't always speak that way, as you were just explaining very well.
Yeah, it's much the same with like the American ultramodernists too. I mean that they came together at a certain historical period and in a specific country, so we lumped them together. Even though, you can't really confuse, Ruth Crawford Seeger's music with Carl Ruggles' music either.
That is true. That is true. And so this, I suppose in a way you've already answered this, but I just want to ask it. So when you're composing this piece, are you going between back and forth between vertical composition and horizontal? So like, okay, this area I need to focus on the vertical texture or pitch interaction. And then maybe in this measures later, I'm w focusing on the horizontal. This is how the line should progress.
Oh, it's both, absolutely. It's both at once.
Oh.
That motive that I talked about that occurs a lot in Penumbra, the falling semitone, I mean the falling whole tone, raising semitone, falling whole tone is a linear idea, but when you compact it together, it forms a 0-1-2-3 set. That's a favorite set that appears, for example, in Bartok's fourth string quartet. There are three cells in that piece, 0-1-6-7. 0-1-0-2-4-6 and 0-1-2-3, and the narrative of the piece, according to Eliot Anticolets, may he rest in peace, is that one of those sets is very sparse. You can basically 0-1-6-7. You can spread it out as interlocking tritones, separated by a perfect fourth. So it's exploring the idea of broken fourths and perfect fourths, and then it condenses into becoming a 0-2-4-6 whole tone sort of cluster, and then that condenses and becomes a 0-1-2-3 completely chromatic cluster, and that's the trajectory of those three interactive cells, propels the first movement of Bartok's fourth string quartet, and so there are a number of sets, but the one that there are a number of sets in Penumbra that do that as well. But the 0-1-2-3 is probably the primary set. And, because it's densely chromatic, it's a fully chromatic tetrachord. You can get a lot of mileage out of purely chromatic linear events and purely chromatic harmonic events, which occur one, sort of mutually reinforcing the other.
They certainly do. And as yourself, as someone who, I was going to say dabbles, you do study post-tonal music. You certainly know many a composer has gotten ton of mileage out of such conceptually small ideas, but they can bore a lot of different things. And I want to highlight a particularly favorite moment of the piece. It's around the 14 to 16 minute mark, so somewhere around there. And I love just the dramaticism, the changing texture between, and I really like it when composers, you switch between quick monophonic textures into polyphonic back and forth, and this dramatic, like, it almost sounds like the instruments are having an argument over the texture. I'm wondering what, maybe you take this question philosophical or more just intellectual with how you compose it. What are you trying to speak in sections that are like this?
Well, this is the IPS of tension release that we talked about before that Patricia Holland identifies. The monophonics texture is more release. It's more direct. It's more directly ascertainable by the listener. And then the polyphonic material is much more dense and opaque and requires a lot more concentration, I think, by the listener. So it's a state of directness and less concentration demanded, and a state of indirectness and more concentration demanded. And it's a kind of a roller coaster ride throughout the 14 to 16 minute mark, as you identified. That was exactly the idea. So tension release is definitely part of it. Also, the harmonic landscape opens up a little bit. It becomes a little bit less crabby, a little bit less chromatic, and audible tonal centers become much more clear that are grounding the textures in that point in the piece.
Wonderful. That makes sense. It does make sense. And continuing to talk about the having a similar kind of conversation, again, one of the most striking moments in the piece is, and I think this is a compliment, I think this is a hallmark of a very well constructed piece, is when the ending has you taking something away from it, almost completely different, or feels completely different than the entire rest of the piece. It's so much more subdued than the rest of the piece. It's calm, it's gentle, feels almost quite sudden. And I am asking, what am I asking? I'm asking, why did you choose to end the piece that way? And yeah, why did you choose to end the piece that way?
Sure. Well, I struggle mightily with endings. Endings are sort of my kryptonite, and I have to think very carefully about them. Sometimes I write the ending, ahead of time, and then write a bridge that takes me to that ending. I think that is indeed what I did in this case. There's a programmatic reason, which is that the whole piece is sort of about the image of the sun, and the sun fighting its way through an eclipse to be seen. And then finally, the eclipse is over, and we see, and that's sort of the 14 to 16 minute mark. We see the sun in all of its clarity, and so we get tonal clarity in the 14 to 16 minute mark. The ending is basically the sundown. Just basically, the sun is setting, and nighttime is falling. And I wanted a music that sort of carries the tropes or topoi of dusk and twilight sort of descending. And that's all it is, really. I mean, it's not a terribly amazing or profound idea, but it works, I think, from the context of the piece. And so that's what I did.
Interesting. I mean, I think the topic of musical endings is one of the most fascinating because in my time speaking with composers on this podcast, I've learned just about everybody has a different idea on how to do endings. I've encountered a lot of different people who struggle with endings
Oh
and
boy.
but wonderful. I thought it was a phenomenal way to close the piece and a wonderful piece overall. And before we move on to the final portion of this podcast, I want to ask you if there's anything else you would like to share about Penumbra.
Well, yeah, sure. It's very loose in its construction, and despite having, like I said, I'm going to kind of sound like I'm contradicting myself a little bit, but despite having a primary motive and a set, and the idea of linear and vertical relationships between sets, the piece is pretty loose in its construction and pretty intuitively written. Sometimes I labor over pieces, and sometimes they just come very intuitively and quickly. And my wife, who has a master's in musicology, tells me that the pieces that I labor over and the pieces that I just write very quickly and intuitively have no discernible difference at all in aesthetic or quality. So that said, I mean, I suppose I could save myself a lot of time and effort if I just wrote everything just completely intuitively and saved myself a lot of effort. But I really enjoy the process of composition. And the more experimental side is almost entirely process driven, regardless of the result. I'm in the experimental side. I'm looking for what is an unknown result that comes from a very devoted and committed approach to process. This is not that. This piece is Penumbra is very much a loose and intuitively written piece.
Well, talking about your influences, I can certainly hear in the background John Cage with his dice talking about process. But wonderful. So, moving on to the last third of this podcast here, I like to open this section with a really general question, which is, Dr. Gross, what does music mean to you?
Well, that yeah, I think listeners to your podcast know that you give the questions out ahead of time. So I did have some time to think about it, and so I don't want to sound too glib, but I don't think music is any one thing. I think there are an awfully lot of valid ways to make music and to write music. I think the world would be very, very boring if everybody wrote music all the same exact way. So to me, music means diversity and variety of sonic organization meant to elicit either an emotional or intellectual response or both. And to me, the music that I'm most attracted to, tends to elicit both an emotional and an intellectual response on my part. If I can get on my soapbox a little bit, I really dislike camps in music, and I dislike what I call the style wars, which are usually comes down to tonality versus atonality or post-tonality, and usually one side adhering to one and the other side adhering to the other, and never the twain shall meet, and claiming that the other side is completely invalid and that theirs is the only valid way to write music. I think that's all hogwash. I think diversity. It between composers and intrafolio diversity among composers is very, very interesting, and should be celebrated. I think composers who are brave enough to buck the trends of their own typecasting, in the world of commissions, it's very, people want to know what they're paying for ahead of time. So it takes a brave composer to write something new or interesting or different from one's own previous catalog. And I think that those efforts should be applauded. And I think that this is a very amazing time to be in contemporary music, because of the breadth of aesthetic diversity available. There's nothing you can't find out there.
That's something I've spoken about a number of times on this podcast. As you're probably aware, music theory can often insulate itself, and sometimes I believe music theorists, and I did for a while, lose sight of what the broader world is. And oh my goodness, there's any kind of music of any type and any style. I mean, just go on to a composer, Facebook, Reddit, whatever. Go to a new music concert at your local college, especially.
Absolutely.
You never know what you'll find, and I bet you money you'll find at least one thing you really like that you had no idea about
Yeah.
before.
In my own listening habits, I intentionally seek out music that is very much not like my own, so that I can discover and maybe add tools to the toolbox and maybe make that my own in the future. Exploration is extremely important to me.
That's one thing I've always appreciated about the composer, and composers that I've met, and the composer mindset is openness. You would hope, generally, but I would say it's quite frequent. And I'm particularly interested to ask you these coming questions I'm thinking about because you have feet in both sandboxes of music theory and composition, not just interest, but practice as well. And you are someone who is studying underrepresented composers who have disabilities. And also, I'm assuming that they are newer composers, post 1950, right?
Yes, that's right. I
Yes. And
mean,
it's
I
kind of
love
fun.
Beethoven, but that's kind of trodden ground.
I couldn't agree more. What is your opinion on the landscape of researching newer composition, which again, it can be so trite to say newer is post 1950, but something written in 1955 is not necessarily new. But in the world of,
Right.
in some music theory circles, it might be. But what is your thought about that when approaching publishing or analytical lens with researching new composition?
Well, I think music theory as a field has really diversified, and just as much as composition is diversified. I think that there's almost a nearly a one-to-one relationship between the diversity in composition and the viability of analyzing whatever is going on in composition from a music theoretic lens. And I think that's incredibly healthy. I think it's a wonderful thing. I think music theory has diversified going beyond the dead white male classical music canon, and I say bravo to that. Myself, I've written music about popular music as well. I've written analysis of people like Curtis Mayfield, Paul Simon, the band Chicago, the aforementioned folk rock artist Galen Lee. And I think that it's wonderful that there's a place for this now. There didn't used to be. Music theory was pretty much the province of what we conventionally colloquially call classical music, and it's really opened up. And I think that's a very healthy thing. I'm also fascinated by this too, which is because of my 18-year-old daughter. She's a gamer, and she is very interested in video games. And there is a legion of amateur music theory sleuths out there, primarily because of Undertale and Deltarune. They're looking for leitmotifs in these games. And they're posting YouTube videos about how they've found, leitmotifs of particular associated with particular characters from these video games. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I mean, making music theory accessible to, amateur sleuthing. That tickles me.
There's all sorts of theorizing happening all the time by people who would not necessarily call themselves music theorists. And I use the example of, let's say, in my case, hip hop YouTubers. The way that's a lot of them speak, just like you're saying, I've seen those video game music videos and music theory videos. There's a lot of, they wouldn't call it that, the content creators, but there's a lot of scholarship happening.
Yeah,
In
that's
that
right.
sense, maybe some of them would. I hope that they do because there's a lot of great ideas where I'm like, huh, wow, I wish I did that first. It would have made a great conference presentation.
Yeah,
Because,
seriously.
yeah, some of them have so many great things. And certainly the field of music theory has broadened quite a lot. I feel very, having learned about the history of music theory, I feel very privileged to exist in the space that it is right now, because it's a lot more generous and friendly a field to things that are not small c classical, of course. And so, oh, I want, so we talked a little bit about music theory with that, and I'm thinking about also the field of composition. You were talking a bit about the style wars. Now, do those still exist as much as they did in the 20th century?
If you read comments on YouTube and on Facebook, they certainly do.
Okay,
So I think
fair enough.
social media, by and large, the algorithms that propel social media foster conflict by nature. And so I think people feel invited to just, go on YouTube and trash. I mean, I've had my music trash. I've been called a no talent on YouTube, and I wear it as a medal of honor, So it's yeah, and it largely falls in the same old tired domains of, tonal versus post-tonal, accessible versus intellectual, et cetera. And I just think that these spectra are really pretty cliche, and that I think that the music that really interests me is a big ball of wax, that it's a big ball, a big glob of music that has dimensions in intellectual ways, but also has dimensions in accessible ways, that maybe is riding the bridge between tonality and post-tonality and fluctuates between the two extremes. Et cetera. I mean, the important thing is it, if it's dynamic, that's what really interests me, is the dynamism of music in all its glory. So yeah, I say down with the style wars. When I was an undergrad, I was in a department that was heavily polarized by camps, and it was a pretty miserable existence. I had friends in all the camps. I was like that kid that is friends with all the cliques. You're friends with the band kids, you're friends with the jocks, you're friends with the theater kids. It was a lot like that, except I was friends with the post-tonal kids. I was friends with the experimental kids. I was friends with the neo-romantics, and I just thought that it was a shame, and it was silly that we weren't all celebrating our mutual creed. I'm not everybody. I mean, I had a few good friends that felt the same way, but by and large, it was very polarized back then.
Yeah,
This was the night I'm dating myself. This was the early 1990s. I'm an
I
old man now.
Oh no, don't do that to yourself. I mean, you're about to go into your PhD.
So,
But
well, there's nothing wrong with being an old man. I
yeah.
embrace it. I mean, being old is a privilege denied to many, so I embrace it.
That's a beautiful sentiment. That is true. And I asked if it still exists only because I feel like if today in 2025, if you are applying for a master's of composition or a DMA, and you went into your interview and they were asking about your stylistic choices or something, and you said, I write post-tonal or atonal, whatever music, because it's the best and it's the only one that exists and it's the only thing that pushes music forward. you're probably not going to get, you're
No,
probably
that's
not going to
right.
get accepted.
No, that's right. It's a well, that's a very anti-creative mindset.
It is.
And I think first and foremost, I would hope that composers are motivated by creativity. And yeah, I agree with that. I do think that in some ways, the pendulum is a little bit more unfriendly to post-tonal concert music composers than it used to be. Pendulums do swing. I think that it's possible that there's us we may be in the middle of a swing back right now, for all I know. But I do think that there's a difference between academia and concert music. I mean, academia, I think there's still room for, healthy post-tonal investigation. Concert music, there's a little less patience for it. We got to sell those tickets. We got to put the butts in the seats. And a lot of people are in survival mode, especially with the current political climate being what it is. I don't think I need to elaborate on that. But I think a lot of organizations are in survival mode right now. And so there's a lot less patience for experimentation and in music that is conventionally understood to be less accessible. But that may change, because trends change. Trends take time to change. They take, years to change.
Yeah, I agree that if you were to like identify where the pendulum is, I would say it's slightly in favor of the tonal land. I think also part of it, and I'm glad you brought this up, is of online discourse because frankly, it's really easy to make a meme out of something that is pretty post-tonal and just take a small snippet of it and say, "Oh, you think this is music?" Or you think this is real? And like to make a joke out of it. By taking something out of context. And
Or
I'm,
four, you mentioned 4:33 by Cave. I mean, that's become memed to say the least. That's become a joke. And it's unfortunate because, I mean, it's a piece that makes a great point, makes an interesting point, which is, what is the nature of environmental sound to music? And that's actually a fairly profound question.
Yes, and I'm glad that you brought up the topic of online discourse as well in music. It's something that I have, even though we have just connected on a personal level just recently, ever since I found you on Facebook, I don't remember when that was, I've been observing your activity in both music theory and composition. Interaction on Facebook, a lot of great stuff happening, and not just posting opinions out into the world, but also having legitimate discussion in the comments, which I do enjoy. It's something that I've thought about, something that I read also was the, I think it's Music Theory Spectrum, colloquially on Public Music Theory. I think
Yeah, that
that's
sounds right. Yeah,
the
that's right.
right jumble of words. Megan Lavingood in
Oh, I love
particular,
her. She's
yes.
wonderful. She's a wonderful theorist.
She is. She specifically talked about her time. I believe it was curating or moderating Music Theory Reddit, which, ooh,
Oh my goodness.
God bless her. I won't, even though I have a music theory podcast.
I've never had the pleasure. Because
Yes.
I mean, I know myself. I can be fairly thin-skinned, so I know that that's probably not a place that is good for me to go.
Yeah, certainly.
I mean,
And
it takes me a week to read my comments from peer review. I mean, I get them in the mail, and then it takes me about a week to talk to my therapist and then gin up the courage to see what they have to say. And
I
I'm not
mean,
exaggerating.
I believe you, and I think that's an experience for a lot of people. And I'm we talked about how like the style wars, the over-exaggerated like dichotomy between styles when it does not exist in the same way that it used to. And I'm also thinking about that with music theory in a way too. It's not like you can you're not going to go into an interview and say that this kind of music is trash and should not be analyzed unless if you're a professor of music and then you get a settlement for U University of North Texas, but that's
Well,
that
No
Oh,
comment.
yeah, that's okay. I'm gonna leave that in for myself
No,
because
please.
I like that joke. But anyways, if you know, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And if you don't know, Google that and it will come up.
Oh, yes. Yes, it will.
But what is your opinion on the landscape of online discourse in nurturing both of these fields, or let's just say the field of music research in academia?
Well, when I do it on Facebook, I try to pose questions that are open-ended and try to foster actual discussion because I don't have all the answers. I mean, seriously, I'm looking for influences and I'm looking for input. It's genuine. And I have a pretty good broad base of Facebook friends anyway that oblige. And it's kind of neat. I mean, I have Facebook friends that are full professors and in music theory. And I mean, like Kevin Clifton, who gave me the term design coherence, he gave me that term on Facebook. So I cite that, Kevin Clifton, comma, Facebook correspondence 2023. So I think it can be a healthy thing if it's done responsibly. And I think that's part of the key is that we have to foster responsible communication. I don't try to trash anybody. I mean, I did, yes. I know what you're talking about the previously mentioned settlement. I did comment on that. I do know some of the particulars involved in that from way back when, before any of this controversy started. And you have to be careful what you do, what you say. I mean, people are watching, people are reading. But I think if you're responsible, you can take a stand and tell people what you stand for. As a broad-based would-be music theorist, I applied to University of Maryland with three papers. My post-tonal paper, which was on Vincent Ho, actually, who's a wonderful Canadian composer. He's post-tonal, wrote a set of super villain etudes on Batman villains. It's a wonderful piece. I encourage everybody to check it out. So I submitted that as my sort of post-tonal classical piece. I submitted a paper on Paul Simon. And I submitted a paper on the Molly Joyce Galen Lee paper to show that I do have a broad base and that I'm not going to just come in and be provincial about what I think music theory means. And apparently that I got into the program, so apparently that was approved and acceptable to my new professors, who I want to give a shout out to. Gretchen Horlocker and Anna Rose Nelson are the two that I have most closely corresponded with so far, and they're just amazing, amazing theorists.
What wonderful. And I, to give a comment of support, I think you are generally that makes it sound like you're not at some point. You are responsible in the discourse that you've
I
been
try.
engaged in. And I asked this only just purely on my own interest. What was the Paul Simon paper on? Because I love Simon and Garfunkel
Oh,
so
I do
much.
too. Yeah, it was about four songs. I think I did Something So Right, which was the name of the paper. Something So Right, Chromatic Inflections in the Music of Paul Simon. And Still Crazy After All These Years, Graceland, and Renee and Georgette Marguerite with Their Dog After the War, which is just four, the latter of which was one of his very best songs. It was never destined to be a hit. I mean, it's a song that fantasizes that the surrealist artist had a secret penchant for doo-wop songs. Do you know the song?
I feel like I've heard of it. I feel like I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's on just about every Paul Simon collection. He really believes in that song, even though it was not a hit, and he puts it on every compilation that he's put out. It's a really neat song. So I just basically analyzed a lot of the chromaticism that takes place. And again, an idea I got from the aforementioned Nils Vigeland was that of structural accidentalism. The idea that especially in vocal music where there's a text associated, you have an accidental that is out of the key signature, that's out of the key, that has potency that seems to pass by unnoticed, but then predicts, larger scale architectonics in the piece. The piece that he pointed to was Schumann's Widmung, which is in A flat. And then, he puts Schumann puts an F flat on the important word Schmerz, which I think means pain. And then that predicts later on the move completely to the key area of E major, predicted by the seemingly innocuous F flat that occurs on an important word. And so I took that idea and ran with it in a pop music direction, because Paul Simon's always doing things lyrically. I mean, he's a very potent lyricist. Ran with that idea to investigate how chromatic inflections map up with the texts. The paper sort of died a death because the primary mode of operations was Shanker, and I was a true believer in Shanker back then. I could go for we could have another hour long discussion on why I am no longer a Shankerian. I've just developed some skepticism about Shankerian analysis after having used it. I remember I listened to your podcast with Dr. Buckler, who said that, you know, he's skeptical of people who criticize Shanker without using it first. I think that's a valid criticism. But I've used it, and now I'm sort of skeptical of it. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah, I think that maybe it's rightfully so, such a massive. Oh well, thank you for sharing your Paul Simon paper, for one. That's really cool. I love
Thanks.
Paul Simon a lot.
I do too.
But I mean, rightfully so. Maybe it's weird to people who are not in the in a music theory brain, but Shankerian analysis, prolongational, it's such an important and complicated discussion in the history of music research and scholarship. I think it warrants its own episode with maybe a couple people on a panel to discuss. But
that's a great idea.
Well,
I want to specify that I still agree with the idea of prolongation. I think that is one of Shanker's most profound contributions, and I still agree with that. It's just that the means and mechanics of how Shanker approaches prolongation, I have some issues with, and we could discuss that at some point, some other time.
Yes, certainly, and I think you have skepticism, rightfully so, in a number of ways. But like you said, perhaps another time. Well, we're coming to a close here for this podcast. This has been a wonderful conversation. But to start with closing, we know that you are going to be starting your music theory PhD. So it's weird to say, oh, what's coming up for you? But how about perhaps an entire another doctorate program other than that? Well, what are some projects on the horizon for you?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. I'm still active as a composer. I'm still going to be active as a composer. I may have to scale back on projects because of the program, but that's okay. You know, that's fine. Composer theorist hyphenate, that's the goal. So I'm working on a woodwind quartet for a friend named Carl Henning in Boston, who has a charming quartet comprised of flute, alto flute, bass clarinet, and bassoon. And so I just finished a piece for him, the first draft, and I think I'm going to stay with this piece and tinker with it a little bit. It needs a better title than Music for, you know, Woodwind Quartet, which is the working title right now, which Carl said to me this morning. So I want to keep the commissioner happy and come up with something. I'm also working on an electroacoustic song setting of a poem by the poet Brad Aaron Maudlin, who teaches poetry at University of Nebraska at Kearney. He's a good friend. And I actually wrote a song cycle called Maudlin Songs that was premiered at Kearney a few years ago for orchestra and soprano. And so this one's going to be completely electroacoustic. And I'm in negotiations with a soprano of note who sings new music, but I won't mention her name because she has not yet signed on to the program yet. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. We'll see. And then I'm working on the Stravinsky graph, and I'm probably going to add a short Webern piece, probably from the pre-12-tone Webern period, the freely atonal so-called period.
I don't remember if you said this before, but are you planning on making that sketch into a paper, possibly?
Yes. Yes, I am. Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. I'm looking forward to that. Perhaps a conference presentation as well, if that's a flavor you like.
Oh, I love doing that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And what would be a good way for the audience to contact you with any comments or questions?
Sure. Just my email. It's the letter R, as in Robert, my first name. Gross, G-R-O-S-S, my last name. Composer, rgrosscomposer@gmail.com. And I welcome inquiries.
Wonderful. That will be in the description wherever you're listening to this. And also on Dr. Gross's profile on the TCC website. Well, let's do our final question. This is one thing I like to give all guests, is a question of Dr. Gross, if there's anything else you would like to add about music theory, composition, music in general, what would that be?
I would say don't get caught up in the style wars. Listen to a broad diversity of music and ignore the camps and ignore the criticism. It would be a very boring world if we all wrote the same music. And I think that diversity among musics and diversity among people is something that we really need to celebrate.
I can't agree more. Wonderful. And so, thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Aaron. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Dr. Robert Gross, for coming onto this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. It's been a wonderful conversation about music theory, about a whole bunch of things, including your wonderful piece, Penumbra, which I'm happy to feature. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hello, this is Aaron again, and I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. I also want to give another big thank you to Dr. Robert Gross for coming onto the podcast. Dr. Gross's contact info is listed in the description, and I would appreciate it if you could show him some support. For further updates and notifications on the Theorist Composer Collaboration, make sure to follow our Instagram and Facebook pages. You can listen to future episodes through our host website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to the platform of your choosing. If you want to monetarily support the work of the TCC, you can click the link to our Buy Me a Coffee page. All donations are highly appreciated. All of the relevant links to follow, listen to, and support the show are in the description. TCC episodes are posted every other week on Mondays, and don't miss our blog posts, which go live a few days before a new episode is added. Make sure to follow our social media accounts and relevant streaming platforms because you won't want to miss it. Until then, this is Aaron, and thank you for joining the TCC.